Welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast, the number one place for dads into self-improvement, or as I like to call it, dad-provement. I'm Joe Horton, and I'm going to be your host for the next hour or so. On each episode of this podcast, I deliver to you conversations that will expand what you think is possible for you across many areas of life and give you actionable resources on a particular topic or a different perspective. I do this by speaking to fascinating individuals, best-selling authors, entrepreneurs and ultra-athletes, professors, psychologists, anthropologists, and also some ordinary dads like you doing some amazing things. It's a tough gig being a dad, and none of us get a handbook for it, but it also represents a golden opportunity for personal growth. If you're anything like me, you're searching out information to be a better, more capable, competent, effective man and father. Someone your kids can look up to and live a life where you're growing, thriving and learning new things, acquiring new skills and knowledge, getting your mental health, physical health, relationships and development in optimal shape, all at the same time as showing up as the best dad you can be. That's what I call dad-provement. There are a few ways you can get involved with Guild of Dads. You can listen to this podcast first and foremost, but you can also follow me over on Twitter and LinkedIn. There's some exciting plans afoot for 2023 coming up, so make sure you follow me to stay up to date with this. I've already started a monthly dad's hike this year for 2 hours every month, which is free to join, set amongst the beautiful backdrop of the Ashdown Forest in Sussex, 1 hour outside of London. You can also subscribe to my newsletter, the Dad Provement Bulletin, which drops one tip fortnightly into your inbox around the subject of being a better man, husband and father. To get info on both of these resources, go to guildofdads.com. If you want to reach out, shoot me a DM as always to say hi or drop me an email to joe@guildofdads.com. On today's episode, I'm delighted to be joined by novelist, writer and mental health campaigner Ian Maitland to talk about his book, Dear Michael Love Dad, which is a memoir about his son's battle with mental health and anorexia a few years back. When most of us think of anorexia, it's not always in relation to young men, but figures suggest that as many as 25% of cases are in the male population. As some of you know, I was brought into the world of child and adolescent mental health services in 2022 as my oldest daughter went through her own battles. So it was great to sit down with Ian as two dads who have run this terrifying gauntlet with our kids and come out the other end. And now to my conversation with Ian. Ian, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
Hello there. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Now, it's an interesting segue into the start of this podcast in that, like I said to you before we came on air, I have been a dad trying to support my daughter through some mental health issues in the last few months, and in particular in relation to eating. And and what happened was, as dads inevitably do, when these things happen, we go into fix it mode. So we're trying to look for bits of information that are going to help us. And your book popped up on Amazon, and I thought, I'm going to grab that. And I chewed it out in a weekend. The book is called Dear Michael Love Dad. And I really loved the book. And what I really loved about it was that it articulated in a really kind of poignant way that the dynamic forms between us and our children, and how we can go about trying to help them through difficult times. What was obviously we'll delve into this during this conversation. What kind of inspired you to put the book into print in the first place, Ian?
Well, we'd had this really long journey with Michael and his mental ill health, really. He'd gone to university, and when he was there, he suffered from anxiety, which he didn't really acknowledge, I don't think, because he just thought, I'm in a new place, meeting new people, everything about it is different. So therefore, it's going to be a time of adjustment. And he never really addressed that. As I say, he didn't really acknowledge it for a long time. And that kind of eventually rolled into depression. And then beyond that, it rolled into anorexia, which was clearly, hesitate to say byproduct, because I wouldn't ever want to underplay the significance of anorexia. But it really came out of his depression. And I think possibly it was his kind of cry for help. But he came out of it. He came back home in 2015. I mean, he went off in 2007. So his journey from kind of going off and then having anxiety and depression and going into the Priory for 5 months and then eventually coming back home was kind of 8 years. And I started writing it, really, I think, just to kind of, I think, come to terms with it. So I kind of wrote his story down, and I'd been a journalist, I guess at that point, maybe 20 odd years. And I'd written for a lot of the nationals, so I kind of knew my way around. I had quite a few other books that had been published over the years, mainly business and finance. So I kind of had contacts, and we put it out there and it got picked up. And that's really where we went from there.
Mm. And in terms of like the book, catalogues the letters that you wrote to him over a period of time when he was at university. Has writing letters always been something that comes naturally to you, or is it something that has come off the back of the fact that you do writing for a living and you have done writing for a living, or was it something new for you to start writing letters like that?
Well, strangely, I'd always written letters to my grandparents. I come from South London, not far from where you come from. And my grandparents, my parents divorced, and it was all very messy. They both remarried, and they had partners who didn't want children, and frankly didn't really want me there. I was very close to my grandparents, and they moved away. It wasn't a million miles away to Sussex, but obviously back in the 70s, that's quite a distance, really, and you're only a teenage boy. So I used to write to my grandmother every week, and I always enjoyed it, and she never really replied, but I know that she treasure them, because when she passed, she had them. So I'd always kind of written letters, and it just seemed a nice way to do it with Michael. They rolled into emails after a while, to be honest. And it was just a nice way of keeping in touch and sort of telling him what was happening at home. I don't think a great deal of it sort of took on board. I think he was on his own world quite early on with anxiety. And then, as I say, the depression. And then he kind of shut himself down quite a bit. But, yeah, it was just a nice way to keep in touch. And I guess I've always been a writer been a full-time writer since kind of 87. So at the time it was kind of 20-odd years. So just writing is an instinctive part of everything that I do.
Yeah. And I like it. I liked hearing the kind of little anecdotes and the kind of some of the funny stuff. And there was bits in it, right, without being a spoiler alert, there was bits in it that really did kind of make me laugh out loud in a kind of, like you say, there's dark, it's almost like a bit of dark humor there, but I think humor is important, because I think it enables us to categorize in our brain experiences that are often quite difficult in and of themselves at the time. And that was kind of what I liked about it. And in terms of like Michael, was he replying to the letters, or was he just kind of reading the letters, or what did you find out about the impact of the letters sometime later, sort of thing?
Well, I came across them. He'd kept them all, but he didn't really respond very much. It was just me kind of telling him what was happening. And as I say, I think probably within a few months, he was already on his downward spiral. But he didn't realize it, as I say, because he's kind of in a new environment and adjusting to it. So he was feeling awful and miserable and unhappy. But he just thought, well, it would be. I'm, you know, completely different situation, miles from home. Don't know anybody really on the course and all these things. And that kind of just rolled and kept going. And it took him a long time to realize it. That's a terrible thing with a lot of mental illness. People that have issues, say with anxiety, they're not aware of it, because they just think, well, you know, at the moment I would feel stressed. We've got all these energy bill issues and petrol's gone out and I've got to pay to go to work or whatever. Whether you're a student or you're an older person, you've got all these things kind of coming at you. And you think, well, I would feel edgy, I would feel stressed, I'd be a bit snappy. And then you obviously come out at a point at the end, you think, maybe when you look back, you think, well, actually, I was a bit more than edgy and tetchy. I was actually suffering from anxiety.
That's a good point you make, actually, because I think with all of us, like, it's kind of like a gradual, slow ebb, isn't it? You don't think stuff comes about so gradually that you don't, and you've only got your own experience to go from as well. So it's not until you speak to other people and you say, actually, yeah, my enthusiasm for life has been pretty bad for quite some time, and that, and then you're like, and then they're like, well, I went through that, and this is what I found out that I'd been suffering from this, and so we can end up being trapped in our own kind of our own brain or our own minds, and I think it's this belief that we're the only ones going through it, and that it's got to be normal because that's all we've ever experienced. It's almost that kind of keeps us trapped, doesn't it?
You kind of adjust your own brain, I think, and without getting too technical or clever, Dickie, but you kind of adjust your own brain as if you're, whatever happens, you're kind of normal. And even though you're acting, you know, not normally, shall we say, you know, you kind of adjust everything around you. So Michael, I mean, there's no great secret. Michael's very happy these days, probably jumping to the end, but things are great. And we'll talk about that later, and how even at your darkest moment, and Michael's had plenty when we thought he would lose his life, you know, you just keep getting through today and get through next week, and one day things will be better. And that's proven the case with Michael. But he looks back now on the diaries that he wrote in the Priory, and he thought those made utter sense to him. And he just says, I can't even believe now when I look at those diaries that I wrote all that. Even that makes no sense to me now. So you kind of, at the time, if you talk to Michael, I mean, talking to someone with mental illness is really tricky because, you know, they're mentally ill. Everybody around them knows it, but they think they're absolutely bang on, perfectly normal. Yeah, kind of brain's adjusting itself. And it's only later when they look back and you think, well, actually, that wasn't kind of, you know, I wasn't in a good place at the time. It's really, really strange how that kind of works.
Yeah. And I think that's a hard thing for relatives as well to deal with as well, isn't it? Where you're not speaking to the real them. You're speaking to it's almost like where Jung talks about these different archetypes that you have and you know, these different parts of your personality. You're not speaking to the normal part of their personality. You're speaking to a version of their personality. And that's hard as a parent because sometimes that version of their personality can be quite aggressive, can be quite rude, can be quite dismissive and argumentative. And that person that you're confronted by, you know, deep down that's not really them.
No.
But that's the version of them that you're having to deal with at that particular point in time, which is really a hard separation to make. You know, some people that understand a little bit about psychology can understand this, but for the regular Joe on the street, they're just like, you know, oh, my son or daughter is just behaving like a monster at the minute. You know, how do I deal with this, you know?
And all the time, even when they're behaving like a monster, you've got to kind of pretend to them that you're not. So it's a really strange kind of dance that you're having between where you've got one person who's mentally ill, probably doesn't recognize it or the extent of it, and the other person, the mum or the dad or the brother, the sister, who recognizes it. But if you go in and kind of attack that and say, look, you know, you're in a really bad place, they don't want to know. Michael, if I'd ever said anything to Michael, he'd have been absolutely horrified, and it would have just pushed him away. So you've got to kind of embrace, terrible phrase to say, I think, but you've got to kind of embrace that madness as if it isn't. And you've got to kind of dance through this together. And it's such a, I mean, Michael's, as I say, was kind of over 8 or 10 years. We didn't realize for a long time. And he didn't realize. And then, you know, he kind of grows up. So he'd been to quite a nice school where it's kind of blazers and ties. And then he went to art college. So his hair changed. He kind of went up that way and black and white. And he had earrings and he just changed his whole look. And you just think, oh, that's okay, that's fine, that's him just kind of growing up and finding, you know, finding himself. And then you kind of think he's losing weight, but you just think, well, he's slimming down. And then, you know, he's putting jumpers on and jumpers on and jumpers on. And then you start thinking, he doesn't look quite right. But, you know, I think also the problem is, I always say to people say, what's the solution, as if there's just like a quick fix. But you say, well, the best thing is kind of to talk to them. Blindingly obvious, really. I mean, I used to talk to Michael about football and Doctor Who and make sure his car had an MOT and he had enough petrol and he kind of had enough just to keep going. But I never once said to him, how are you? How are you feeling? Mm. You know, what's going on inside? Because it wasn't, we weren't like that as a family. We were a happy family. I've been with Tracy since I was at school. So kind of 40 years now, 30 years ago when Michael was, going downhill. Only we've got three children, Michael, and he's got a younger brother and a younger sister. And we're all happy, we're all kind of doing our own thing. And then you suddenly just find out that Michael isn't happy at all. And it's, you know, it's such a blow. And you just don't really know how to address it. I think that's the big thing. I think as dads, we kind of charge in and we say, well, you know, Michael's not eating. Well, that's an easy one. Just eat this and here's this and eat that. But, of course, it's all, you know, tied up in his mind as to with all the other mental health issues. And you say, well, these are the fixes. Just do this, this, this and this and you'll be fine. And, of course, you know, it doesn't work, does it? As I'm sure you've found yourself with children, have you?
Yeah. It's I remember in the book you kind of wrestled with this, you know, of how you the way you are in with your kids, and you know the kind of person you are in terms of, you know, asking him whether how he feels and things. And I think that this is the it's a very interesting conversation, this, about asking people how they feel and that, because I know you kind of sort of beat yourself up a little bit about should I have been more sort of caring and should I be more this, but also I think when people are in that zone, they're almost caught up in their own perfectionism and I can deal with this myself, you know what I mean? And so it's debatable whether if you said how you feel and whether that actually communicate exactly what they're feeling in any event, you know?
I mean, as I say, our family was a loving one and is still a loving one, and we're all still very close. They all still live locally and we see them, you know, all the time. But I just don't think it was in us really to kind of deal with it. My wife and I both had quite tricky backgrounds, as I say. My parents divorced and that was quite a sticky time. And my wife's mother died, and I think her family, you know, that was quite obviously a big deal, but it was, you know, a difficult thing to handle. So kind of both came out of situations where I hadn't seen my father since I was 18 and my wife, Tracy, hadn't seen her mother since she was 17. We kind of walked away from it all. So we had this sort of terrible fear that if we confronted Michael, he had a girlfriend at the time who kind of tried to protect him. Probably saved his life, if I'm completely honest. She kind of acted as his gatekeeper. But we felt if we did kind of charge in that, you know, we might have a situation where we lost him forever. Mm-hmm. So the thing with this is there's no rights or wrongs. You know, you're just kind of like fumbling in the dark. And you've got your own kind of background issues that you think, well, I can't do this. I've never been out. I mean, I put it in the book. I find it always very hard. Better now. Got, you know, two small grandchildren. So I hug them and they get lots of, you know, fuss and bother. But I just couldn't show emotion or affection terribly well. I did it all in the practical sense. You know, I made sure that, as I say, you know, MOTs and petrol and all of that stuff. But I mean, I struggled. So I felt, I mean, I think one of it was either the Daily Mail or the Daily Express put something like, you know, when they reviewed the book, Dear Michael Loved Dad, you know, his guilt drips off every page. And I think that's the thing. And as Michael has said to me later, he didn't blame us for anything. He said this was just the journey that I was on and I had to turn it around myself, which is kind of good and bad, I guess.
Well, the thing is, you do what you think's right at the time. And I think there's a balance, isn't there? You can either go in all guns blazing, you know, or you can just take, you know, just be so laid back that you don't do anything. And I think it's a navigating that balance and trusting your gut instincts and trusting your instinct to think, right, okay, we're going to adopt this course of action. And I think this is the best course of action, but I might need to pivot this or change it at some stage. I think it's having that faith in your course of action. And I think that notion of what you just mentioned about the review about pages dripping with guilt and stuff, that you've got to see that within the context of the fact that much of the kind of discussion around men's mental health is around men showing their emotion and men being more emotional and stuff and that. But I have interviewed a guy called John Barry, who you can look him up on Twitter. His handle is Male Psychology. He's written a book, Perspectives in Male Psychology. And interestingly, he puts a point across in the book that men and women, from a sort of psychological therapeutic point of view, the therapy for men and women is quite different, in the sense that men don't always want to talk about how they feel. They process in a completely different way to what women do. And there is this push towards a one size fits all method of how men and women interact now. So seen through that lens, you could say, oh yeah, every page is wrapped with guilt or whatever. But in actual fact, I think that the discussion around male and female psychology is a hell of a lot more nuanced than that. And sometimes the mainstream media get caught up in this, oh, men should be this and men should be that, rather than actually saying, well, actually, let's be a bit more sympathetic about what we're dealing with here. You know what I mean? It's a lens through which people are seeing stuff at the moment, for sure. So
The media, we probably shouldn't get onto the media too much, but very black and white. We had, when Dear Michael Love Dad came out, Michael helped me to promote the book, and we had one of the nationals come up and they interviewed us, and they sent some photographers up, and we kind of stood here, there and everywhere, and they did it, and the photos went back to the editor at this big national newspaper. And they said, we can't use those photographs because Michael has tattoos. So he's got tattoos, obviously, all up his arms and everything. And the feedback was, we can only have someone with tattoos in the newspaper if they're kind of, you know, being charged with murder or sexual assault or something awful. You can't just have someone who just has them as a body art, as Michael did. So they sent another photographer back up on a Sunday morning. This was going to run through, you know, a week in the paper. And they said, we've got to take pictures of Michael, and he's got to kind of do this up so that you can't see any tattoo. Got a few around here as well. And he said, no, I won't do it. He said, because that's me. I am, those tattoos represent everything. You know, there was a rose of my mother, his grandmother, who's passed away. And it's just, my life is all in these arms. And so they went off in kind of high dudgeon, and they dropped the whole thing, which was a bit of a shame, really, in terms of sales. But of course, you have to admire Michael for saying no. That's me with all the tattoos. So, but that's the media. They kind of put you in boxes, and it's kind of, you know, good, bad, dad, and all these different things.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's kind of peculiar. It's very peculiar. That's such a weird story.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's the Daily Mail, of course, so you possibly might do now. But it was such a strange thing that Michael... They'd only take photographs and put them in the newspaper. I don't know if it's still the same now. We'll have to flick through the Daily Mail. Is anyone with tattoos, are they criminals and convicts? There can't be anybody that's nice or happy or jolly. You can't have tattoos and be a nice person. Crazy world.
Yeah, only middle class upstanding young men suffer from mental health issues, and anyone that's got
then you're fine, you know. But I don't know. This is the thing with mental health. People come at it from so many different directions, and it's a strange thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so you, in the book, you talk about how you can see this kind of gradual deterioration over a kind of period of time, and I think he was at an age where, okay, he's an adult, he's still your son, but he's an adult, so you're kind of, you've also got this kind of extra layer that I can't really tell him how to live his life. I've got to kind of let him live his own life, but at the same time, I still want to keep an eye on him and stuff and that. And that was quite an interesting dynamic that I could see unfolding as well, where you feel responsible, but you want to kind of cut him loose a little bit. Is that something you kind of grappled with? I got a sense of it in the book to a certain extent.
Well, I think it's a common dad thing, really, isn't it? You can see what you perceive to be your children's, perhaps not mistakes, but where they're perhaps going down the wrong path. And you just want to say, well, look, you know, don't go that way, go this way. But then at the same time, you've got to kind of let your children live their lives, which is what I always do, which is what I have tried to do more lately with all three of my children, just kind of be there if they need anything, but let them get on with it, to be honest. And I don't know if that's good or bad or not, but certainly with Michael, when he was at university, it was quite a dilemma inside, really. You know, you kind of think, well, as dads, you can kind of rush in and say, do this, that, and the other, and everything will be fine, which is your perception of his situation being turned around with kind of, you know, your thoughts and beliefs. So I think you've got to let them, as I say, Michael's always said, you know, he was always going to go where he was going to go. So however much I intervened or tried to kind of push him or nudge him in a certain way. And if ultimately, you know, if you've got, you know, he's kind of 20, 21 at this time, 22. I mean, you know, what is a dad's role? Is it to kind of be there supportive if you're asked, or is it to kind of go in? And of course, the issue is with Michael and with a lot of, I guess, with a lot of students, especially as we're coming up to that time now where, you know, another wave of young people are going off to university. Where is the cutoff line? Are you just there saying, I'm here if you need me? Or do you kind of get stuck in? I mean, I'd hate to be one of these parents that kind of has this terrible control over all aspects of my children's life. But where's the balance? I don't know.
I'm just going to jump into the conversation quickly. I'm pretty excited to let you know that I have a membership brotherhood exclusively for dads called the Guild of Dads Brotherhood. If you're a dad into self-improvement and you want to get the accountability, camaraderie and resources of being amongst others on your dad-improvement journey, then this is for you. Regular Zoom calls, monthly topics, deep dive trainings, accountability and a system of self-improvement built in will see you beginning to really thrive in multiple areas of your life and develop more purpose, resiliency and confidence. To find out more, drop me an email, joe@guildofdads.com, and I can give you some more information. Yeah, it is. And there's a really brilliant quote that someone I know has come out with a few times, and it's our job as dads is to make ourselves redundant. And it's kind of true in a respect, because yeah, because our job is to gradually kind of taper off that support, so that you can then kind of cut them loose, sort of thing. But I think what's interesting about your experience was you got to the point of kind of almost cutting him loose, but then you actually no, I want to grab hold of that bit of rope again, because I want to hold on to it a little. I want to reel him back in a little bit, because something's not right here, you know.
Well, the thing is, you know, you let them loose, but then Michael's got his, I let go of the rope, Michael's heading for the edge of the cliff. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you think, oh, goodness, you know, and as I say, 5 months in the Priory. So what do you do? And do you try and fix these issues? You can see the issues that eventually they're staring at you. You can't ignore them anymore. What do you then do as a father or as a parent? Do you try and fix it? Do you try and get help? I mean, I wrote in the book about going to see a doctor and I was really on the edge of tears, if I'm quite honest, very close to not even getting through the conversation. So I was really on edge. And she was a youngish doctor, and she said, what's his name? And I gave a name. So she typed it in, and she said, oh, he's not on our list. And I was kind of like, well, I'm just desperate for help here. Please help me. And it was, you know, in my really highly charged state at that time, I got up and walked out, because my perception was that she wasn't going to help me because, you know, he wasn't on the database. So, you know, you try and go for help, and then you think, well, what do I do? I mean, you know, with the state that Michael was in at one point, you can move to have him sectioned, and you think, well, you know, that's the ultimate pullback on the rope. Then you wrap it around him and you push him away, and you think, well, what happens to us, our relationship, if I have you sectioned? I might save your life temporarily, but will you never ever speak to me again for the next 40 years or whatever? So, you know, there's these terrible dilemmas, and certainly at the time, you know, GPs weren't terribly tuned in. I know later Michael said that he went through lots of GPs and they'd say, well, here's different tablets and here's more tablets, less tablets or whatever. And then you go on waiting lists. I mean, we were fortunate that we could afford stuff, you know, blessed position, really. But you're on this waiting list and 6 months, 12 months or whatever before you can get proper help. And you think, well, he won't be here in 6-12 months at the rate he's going. So,
Yeah, and I can completely relate to that, given my experience in the last few months. And what was your kind of experience of, you know, you've alluded to it. What was your experience of seeking help? Obviously, you're a few steps removed in the sense that by this point he's now an adult, so he's not like a minor in the sense that you can drag him along to the GP, you know, and plonk him down and say, right, this is something that's not right here. What was your experience of kind of actually being able to, you know, because we spoke briefly about this off air, this notion of, yes, the help's here, but you're going to go on a list, and it's kind of list like it's this. You go through the highs of thinking, yeah, I've got help now, and then the lows of, it's not coming anytime soon. So it's kind of the constant roller coaster of a glimmer of hope, and then it's just like your hopes are completely dashed when you think the cavalry is about to arrive. You know,
well, the problem is that wherever you talk to, I mean, I'm very fortunate. Both Michael and I are ambassadors now for a truly wonderful teenage mental health charity called STEM4. It's literally STEM4.org, probably org UK. But you can Google them, and they do all sorts of calm harm apps and different things. And certainly up till the pandemic, we went and talked to in schools and colleges all over. And the whole system, the help system, if you want to call it that, all over the country is different. But I think with the NHS, it's hard to access. It's supposedly better these days. Whenever I do a talk and make a slightly negative reference, a doctor will come up and say, well, in our practice, we have someone specialised and they do it. But, you know, you talk to people, and I'm not sure it's much better. The breakthrough for us, and this was at the point when Michael came home, and we thought he would take his life that night. So just the most horrendous moment of our lives, to be honest. And I always sometimes struggle to get through it. So if I suddenly do this, you know I'm having a wobbly moment. But he came back and I didn't know what to do. Neither myself or Tracy knew what to do. And there's a local, I forget the name of it now to my shame, but there's a local eating disorder charity. And I rung them up and I spoke to a brilliant woman. And she said, I've suffered from mental health issues. I've suffered from depression. I've considered suicide. And I've had pretty much all the issues that your son's had. Whatever you want me to do, I will do. I will come out now at kind of 10:30 at night, and I'll sit on the street corner or in a car with you, and we'll go through it. You want me to talk with your son, I'll do that. If you feel that might work, obviously a tricky one. And she was just absolutely fantastic. And that's kind of a hidden service in a way, rather than going to your GP, which is what we always have to say you should do in the first instance, go to your GP, because they can act as a signposting thing. But they're obviously crippled with budgets and long lists and queues and all sorts of things. But there are these kind of little charities all over the place, and the people that are involved with them have all been down the road that you're going down with your children. And some of them are brilliant. As I say, she said, well, I'll come out, I'll sit in the car with you later in 20 minutes, and we'll just talk. And if you want to kind of break down and sob and hug me, you can do that. If you want some practical advice, we can do that. And she was brilliant. And I really took my breath away, because you always automatically just assume that you've got to go to your GP or you've got to go into A&E because you think your child's about to take their own life. But there are these little kind of nuggets of wonderful groups of human beings out there that you've got to try and find.
Yeah, there's guardian angels on the peripheries of humanity that kind of come out of the woodwork in the most, when you least expect it, these people seem to come out of the woodwork, and that it opens up a completely other layer of humanity and, good Samaritanism that you just don't. That is kind of quite alien, because when you're in the kind of healthcare system, it's very clinical and it's very tick boxy and it's very checklisty, and I think that to your point about doctors saying to you, oh, we've got this practice and we've got this protocol and whatever and stuff, that's all great, but I think the problem is action speaking louder than words. And I think that I'm I'm of a generation where, you know, people did get on the telephone and deal with stuff, and, you know, people didn't just send an email and wait for a response. You know, mm-hmm. you'd pick up a phone, you speak to someone that knows what they're talking about, you'd get a response, you'd get some kind of stepping stone as to what is going to be the next stepping stone. But I think the problem is now with, like you say, there's cuts, but also I think there is this, people sort of email and they're like, right, that's a problem off my desk. I don't need to deal with that anymore. And if it's like, that's like a hot potato. I'm going to chuck that. And one thing we noticed, you know, my daughter was in hospital a few weeks back, and I spoke to my wife on the phone, and as I was getting to the hospital, I said, so have you heard from the eating disorder service? No. Have you heard from CAMHS? No. So I'm like, so I'm sitting in the hospital car park, ringing these people, you're chasing people up, and you're just like, and I think that it's that stuff. Parents shouldn't have to do that, but we're going to do it. But it's that stuff that is just exhausting on a daily basis, you know, chasing this stuff up, and then it goes to an answer phone, and then sort of, you know, you don't get a response or whatever and stuff. And I think that compounds our sense of frustration as parents, you know, quite a lot. I think
the thing is, it's something that parents don't always realize at the start of a journey. And I hope your journey is a short one, but a lot of parents don't realize that they think, well, if they go to the GP or they see this, it'll kind of be fixed. The one thing that we did find, and it's a horrifying moment when you realize it, it's down to you, the parent, mum or dad, or hopefully the two of you together, or whatever, you know, mix you have, you know, in your family. But it's down to you, and it's horrible, and you've got to be the one that does it all. And as I say, we were very lucky that this absolutely wonderful human being said she'll come and sit in the car and talk to me. We then found Michael, and it's a real trial and error, this. We found him a therapist that he could go and talk to. And that's very, very interesting, because you really got to find one that matches your child. So with Michael, we first got him to a man who was very sort of like this. So when Michael went through the door, kind of like, you know, virtually on his last legs, this guy had his fists in his face. Come on, and all of this. And Michael just completely kind of recoiled from that. And he found an absolutely wonderful woman who worked nearby, and she'd suffered from depression, and she just kind of sat him down, and they just, I hesitate to say burbled away, it sounds a bit kind of negative, but they just kind of chit-chatted away, and eventually when Michael was ready, what he needed to talk about came up. So, you know, if you find someone, they've got to be a good match as well, because certainly the first one that Michael went to, he came home and he was kind of like, I can't go and see that one again. Because I just can't face having to kind of stand in the corner and jump up and down and say, yes, I feel great, when really he just wanted to kind of get into bed and pull the duvet over his head.
And it's
a maze out there, isn't it? That's the thing. I mean, you know, we talked off air a little bit about your own situation with your family, and it's a minefield, a maze, whatever you want to do, you've got to kind of navigate your way around. And there are no rights and wrongs. And it would be lovely if we could kind of hold up a checklist now and say, point one, talk to your child. Point two, do this. Point three, or do's and don'ts. Don't ever do this. Don't ever do that. And then, you know, when they're ready, go and get them to talk to the GP. Well, I mean, any parent that's got a teenage child, the idea of saying, right, you're coming to the GP and we're going to sit down and sort this is probably not going to work with very, very many of them, is it? So, you know, it's so easy. I wish I could come up with solutions, as I'm sure you do as well. Maybe we're throwing out a few ideas here for people, but, you know, you've got to take it on your shoulders. It's down to you. Don't pass it to your GP. You've got to get in there, and you are going to sit in hospital with no one taking any notice because they're out for a curry or whatever, or, you know, they've got their mates around, and you're sitting there, and your child is in this hospital bed, or more likely in a corridor waiting to go in a hospital bed. And it's horrendous at times. I mean, I'd never want to kind of promote my own journey and my wife's journey as worse than Michael's. But, I mean, as a parent, it's tough. It's really, really tough. And at the end of the day, as Michael's always said, you know, he went on a journey and it was hit for him to turn it round, and he started the journey and it was up to him to finish it. And it's, you know, it makes you feel as a parent, well, what can I do?
And Yeah. I think it's, I was talking to a previous podcast guest, funny enough, yesterday, and I always see this quote of life changes when you realize that nobody's coming to save you. And it's kind of like a cliche, but I think it's true. And I think it's true of the experience that parents go through on this, that you realize, hang on a minute. So we have, I don't know. I think we all have this kind of idea that there is mechanisms in society that are going to catch us when we fall.
Hidden mechanisms, and we'll just call them and they'll come running, and suddenly they don't.
Yeah, and I think the reality is whereas, and I've noticed this, and it sounds like really cynical as I've got older, that I've realized that actually each time that I've needed that to happen, it's not happened, and it's never going to happen in my lifetime. So then you're left with this situation of, okay, what do I do in this situation? And you've got, right, okay, so I've got to come up with a plan. Some plan's better than no plan. So you almost assign yourself as the project manager of this project.
Yeah.
And then you have to sort of take the steps that you think are right at the time. And one thing that I've learned is that, you know, and I was talking to my wife about the other night, you know, is not trying to solve all the problems in one day. I actually just say, okay, let's just get to the end of today, and then we'll start in the morning, and then we'll get to the end of the next day. And it sounds a really simple thing to do, but actually it's a really powerful skill when you're in the midst of it, isn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, as I say, I wrote in the book, my son comes home and we talk, him and my wife and myself, and he's a wonderful artist. He's absolutely magnificent. And he came up, I'm sure he won't mind me telling people this, but that night when we thought he was going to take his own life, he said, could I get him a job in, this is how far removed he is, you see, and he thinks he's normal. Can I get him a job? Because I've got a few contacts, not masses, but, you know, could I get him a job at Disney in Los Angeles or wherever? And then he'd fly out there in the summer and everything would be fine. And you just don't know what to say to that. Because, you know, you think, my goodness, that's just so awful. So you've got to kind of drag him back from that. And then he goes to bed that night and you lie there in your bed. We've got three stories. So he was down below us and we were kind of listening. And if the door opens and he comes out, is he heading to Orwell Bridge, which is a huge bridge near us in Felixstowe, going towards Ipswich, where tragically a lot of young people do end their lives. And we thought, you know, if the door goes, we've got to kind of go after him. And, you know, and you just think, well, if I just get through tonight, we get through. I got up, I think, about 3 or 4 a.m. and I went in there and he was awake and we had a tense conversation, but he was still there. And we thought, great, we got through today. We just got to get through the next day where hopefully we can find him someone who he can talk to. So you just have to get through the next bit. I think plans are great. And I think, you know, that's a really strong, good piece of advice. But you possibly don't want too long a list because you just want to get through the first point on the first day. And the end bit, which is for Michael, would have been, let's go over to Los Angeles and draw, you know, the next the Buzz Lightyear movie or whatever. You know, let's leave that quite down near the bottom. Let's just get through today and have a breakfast and eat breakfast or whatever, you know.
Yeah, holding on to normality, and you find yourself putting out fires as well. Like I found that, you know, even though, you know, their issue may be around eating, it may well be that they're not sleeping or they're not looking after themselves in terms of like washing or something like that. And find yourself putting out one fire, only have to, and then another fire starts somewhere else. You know, like, oh, okay, so let's try and, I've just put that one out. Let's try and deal with this one now, sort of thing.
Your son's kind of got anorexia and suicidal, and he's possibly not the most fragrant smelling young man at the time. And do you say to him, my goodness me, you stink, and make a joke of it? Or do you kind of just avoid it? Yeah, there's so many bits and bobs that kind of come out of this. And of course, the thing with anorexia, which is what Michael had, and for which he went into the prior for 5 months and that was treated, that was kind of, you know, that wasn't the root issue. That was kind of a result of the depression and how he felt about himself and low self-esteem. So often sometimes you're kind of looking this way, thinking, well, he's anorexic, we've got to get him to eat. But for Michael, that was the first step, because otherwise he would have just gone. Mm. So you've got to kind of keep him, get him on that BMI scale or whatever it is. But then it's, in without being remotely disrespectful of anorexia and those that have are experiencing it, for Michael, it was like an offshoot, or you know, we had to kind of delve further and further down. And that's often the case with a lot of mental illness issues. It's you're looking at something that's at the front, but it's really what's going on behind that's the thing. Mm. So we could, you know, the first thing, when Michael went in the prior, as I say, for 5 months, he's a smart boy, a smart man, really, I should say. And he knew that to get out of that priory, he had to kind of basically get his weight to a certain level. And then when they did a conversation with him, not kind of give away that there was anything wrong with him. So he was kind of, he knew how to play the game, even though he was in there 5 months, which is quite a long time. He felt he kind of worked the system. But when he came out, we thought, oh, that's great. Priory have cured him. But to be honest, you know, that was the beginning of it. It kind of got worse from there. He was in there, I think, 2012. We're going back a while, of course, with this story. His early 30s now. He was a teenager when it all started. And so he was in the Priory 2012. And then he came out and we thought, yes, he's sorted. And we haven't had to do very much with it. And then, of course, 2012 to 2015, it just got worse and worse and worse and worse. And he got engaged, he got married, and then his marriage broke up because of his mental illness, and he lost, you know, everything, really, and he came back home, and 2015 was kind of the worst point. So it's, you know, it's such a hard thing to deal with, because you're looking at one thing and it's something else, and it's not an easy world.
Yeah. We're coming to the end of our discussion, Ian, and like I say, it's been really interesting reading through the book and how you catalog the story. And there's obviously another part of it that comes on after mm-hmm. that. But I think I definitely recommend for people to check the book out, because it really does, like I say, it gives a very poignant account of how you did your best to kind of cope with what was a very difficult situation, but also how you reflected on, you know, what it meant for your relationship and how you are and your own upbringing and stuff. And that, and it was just a very candid account. For if people want to find out about a bit more about you or look you up, what is the best way for them to do so, Ian?
Well, I mean, it's Ian Maitland, I-A-I-N, Maitland, M-A-I-T-L-A-N-D. If you Google, you'll find me pretty easily. I've got a website and Twitter and all of that. And STEM4, do have a look at that. They're absolutely wonderful. Michael and I are SAR ambassadors, and that's STEM4.org, or possibly STEM4.org.uk. And they've got a Youth Mental Health Awareness Day coming up in a week or two. And they've got a lot of kind of information that's out there. So if you've got a teenage son or daughter, then that's a really good place to start. I mean, if you look at my website, I'm just going to flog you a book, but if you go to STEM4, you'll possibly change your life, because there's really some wonderful sort of calm harm apps and all sorts of things. And we're so proud to be part of it, and to have gone out and about in schools and colleges and just kind of chipped in with our story. But yeah, that's the place to really go.
Brilliant. And what I'll do is I'll link that up in the show notes, so if anyone's listening, they can click a link in the show notes and it will just take you straight through to the STEM4 webpage as well. So, all right, super duper. Ian, I'm going to ask you one more question that I don't prime any of the guests for, and people that are regular listeners to the podcast will know that I'm kind of like quite interested in the subject of meaning, having been heavily influenced by the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Ian, what is it in life that gives you meaning?
My family, I suppose, without being too emotional about it. I mean, I'm lucky. I've been with my wife Tracy since 1979, since we were at school. So that's a wonderful thing. Very fortunate. I've got three children, Michael, who lives locally with his partner, Georgia, and their two-year-old son, Jonah, coming up to two. He works as a tattooist in Felixstowe. And I've got my daughter Sophie and her partner, her fiance Glenn, and they've got a little girl who's actually downstairs at the moment. We're babysitting. My wife's downstairs, I should add. I've not kind of just left her down there. Hallie. And I've got a son, Adam. We've just been up to Liverpool with him. We had a couple of Beatles days, which was great fun. And he's got a lovely girlfriend called Sophie as well. So family really is the meaning of my life. It all kind of brilliant, really. I mean, it's ended up really well. I mean, certainly the night Michael came home and I thought, this was it. We're at the end of the road. And then here we are kind of 10, not perhaps not quite 10, but, you know, a good 5, 6, 7 years on, and things are wonderful. And the last thing I would say, if I may, is that wherever you are at the moment, however dark it is, either for yourself or your child, and, you know, I've sat there with a text message expecting my son to die in the next literally 10 minutes, and I've had him at home expecting him to take his own life. Even at these very darkest moments, there is hope. Michael's a very happy man now. His life's turned around, and he did it simply by, as you referred to slightly earlier, getting through today. He got through today, and he got through tomorrow, and he got through next week, and he did it step by step, very slowly. Terrible moments he had at times, but he just kept going, and it very slowly got better. And then one day he woke up, and you know, his life was where he's always wanted it to be. So you've got to hang in there.
Yeah, I love that, and I think the other thing that I like, following on from what you've just said there as well, is that some of these things we think are a solution, but they're a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And and I think when we're in the midst of it, we lose sight of that. I think all of us do. I think.
Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah.
So, Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure. I wish you the very best on upcoming books, and obviously, hopefully, our conversation will bring you some new readers of Dear Michael, Love Dad, and it's been an absolute pleasure, sir.
Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Take care. If you want to find out a bit more about Ian, you can check out his work at ianmaitland.net. His book is called Dear Michael, Love Dad. And the teenage mental health charity we discussed is called STEM4. Their website is stem4.org.uk. So that's STEM4.org.uk. It's definitely worth checking out that website. There's a ton of really good resources on there, regardless of whether or not your child is actually being diagnosed with a mental health condition. There's a load of resources on there that are really helpful to any parent of a teenage child right now. You can also drop in a follow over on Twitter. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the greatest compliment you can give me is a rating or review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Also, share with friends or relatives you think may benefit. And don't forget, look me up and follow on Twitter and LinkedIn. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.